We're going to do Communion Eucharist a bit later. Carla's going to take us through that. But first, we're back on this path called compelling, and we're still at the trailhead. We're not going to get to the actual path for another couple of weeks. Gathered, you could say, at the trailhead. We've got to talk about a few things about this trail before we get going. Years ago, I received an email from someone who had been attending Nexus for a little while. And the email to me ended on a curious note. It said this: "So, I'm really enjoying Sunday mornings at Nexus, and I find the way you talk about faith refreshing, though you haven't converted me just yet." Closing line made me laugh. I thought it was brilliant because it sort of cheekily seemed to undress my intentions, my ulterior motives, and it made me chuckle when I read it, but it started getting under my skin. It had me thinking to myself, Is that what I'm about, converting people? Is that what I'm about as a pastor? Is that why I preach, why I write, to convert people to Christianity? Is Nexus about evangelizing people? Now, I can imagine this seems like a rather obvious question to some of you. I'm a pastor of a church. Of course he's trying to evangelize and convert people. But it sort of left me a little unsettled because it was almost like what this person was saying in this email is like, hey, I don't mind showing up and sort of following along a little bit, but if you think you're going to get me to sign the dotted line, I wouldn't count on it. And maybe for some of you who are new here, maybe you're thinking something similar. Okay, I'm intrigued, but I don't think you're going to get the conversion thing. Or maybe you've been hanging around here at Nexus for a while, and you're like, I don't know, am I in, I don't know. Is my work about converting people, is our work as a church about that? Well, I want to unpack these questions. It's a little bit more complex, I think, a little nuanced here. I want to dive into that before we get journeying on the trail itself. So hang with me a little while longer because I want to set the record straight on a few things. Let's start with Jesus in the classic evangelism or conversion mandate passage. It's found in the Gospel of Matthew. And after Jesus' resurrection, before he ascends to the heavens, of course, he's talking to his disciples. It's like a farewell. The Holy Spirit's going to come. He's going to take off. And his last message to his disciples in Matthew is this. He came to them and said, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I've commanded you, and surely I'm with you always to the very end of the age." Now, no matter how you cut it or want to call this, there's just no getting around that Jesus was a movement starter, a movement initiator. And this passage is one of the most explicit passages we have of this. In this passage, Jesus is telling the ones who were following him to go out and get more people to follow him. And granted, you can argue, as many have, that Jesus came to end religion, or that Jesus was all about a religionless faith. For most of us, though, we know religion when we see it. So you can call a skunk a cat if you want, but the smell tends to give it away. And I'm thinking for the vast majority of people, like my friend who emailed me, talking about the end of religion or religionless faith sounds like a bit of a farce. If a group has a set of beliefs and practices and rituals and they meet together Sunday mornings and those meetings look and feel a lot like other religious gatherings, chances are that group is religious. Moreover, if this religionless faith also seems intent on creating more followers, again, you can call that what you want, but when people talk about evangelism, this is what they're talking about. The desire that some Christians have to share their good news and convert others to it. So, let me be upfront, the very beginning of this series, because I don't want to play games. I'm religious. In fact, I'm trying to be more religious, and I'm also an evangelist. So, now you know, but let me add this. So are you. In fact, virtually every single person I know is an evangelist. What do you mean? Well, evangelism simply means this: to share good news. And I don't know about you, but today it feels like everyone has some good news to share with me. There's, of course, the good news of capitalistic materialism, you know, some product promises me something good, but I'm talking more specifically about the people like you that I interact with day in and day out. Every week, some enthusiastic person is trying to convert me to something. The good news can be anything, really. And it often comes with the zeal and testimonials of an old-time gospel revival meeting. Vegans. It's going to be interesting. I go through my list here. Who chuckles here? Vegans, keto diet folk, mountain bikers, beer connoisseurs, Kanye West fans, though they've been rather quiet lately. But they used to be. Gardeners, Norwex enthusiasts, partisan political people, kombucha lovers, ultimate frisbee players, wine enthusiasts, essential oil gurus, people convinced that I will love this author, that band, that television show, that film, that poet, magazine, blogger, whatever it is. Pastors? Yes. That'd be a good one. Every week, I hear somebody share good news with me. And they're eager to share it with others. I'm assuming you've had similar experiences. Everyone is an evangelist. Everyone. You, me, all of us. So, welcome to the club. Because if you've ever tried to share or convince someone of something that was meaningful, maybe life-altering in some way to you, we have a name for that. We call it evangelists. So welcome to the club. We're all in this together for good or ill. And the thing is this, I don't think people have a problem per se with the idea of evangelism. Most people are an evangelist for something. The problem most people have is with the feel of evangelism. Because some people in life share their excitement with their good news. It's like running into a kid who has discovered the world of dinosaurs, right? And there's an innocence about their joy and wanting to talk to you. They just want to talk to you about dinosaurs. And it's innocent and pure. But other people, when they share their good news with you, it feels arrogant or presumptuous or insufferable. But it could be about religion or anything else. And I generally enjoy people experiencing and sharing those things that they experience as life-giving. But some people in life, it doesn't matter what they're peddling, religion or the latest fad diet, it just feels ugh when they talk to you about it. And the truth is, because of religion's history with evangelistic efforts, most often Christian evangelism feels like the latter of the two, right? Feels like something distasteful. And we've seen evangelism and religion done poorly. It's become a sort of illegitimate practice because evangelizing others to faith in the way that's often done, it feels obnoxious, arrogant, condescending even. And so what I would say is this, I'm not so much interested in converting you to the Christian path, but I do want to show you why the Jesus path is compelling. And to me, the difference between being converted or evangelized to something and being compelled by something is paramount. The difference is paramount. I want to show you what I think the difference is. How many of you, if you've been around Nexus for a while, remember Dave Smith? Anyone remember? Okay, right, a few of you do, yes. He attended here for years before he moved to Vancouver, and for those who knew Dave, he was the healthiest person anyone knew. He works out every day. In fact, he worked out the morning after his wedding. I remember I'm on Instagram, and he's like, morning after the wedding workout. I'm like, what? Like, I can think of some other things I'd rather do the morning after my wedding, but no, he's there working out. He had the strictest of diets, and he owned his own gym. He was named Canada's top professional fitness person of the year. And he was so dedicated to health that, as a friend of mine, he was outspoken you could say, about his concern for my well-being. And I got the feeling around Dave that I was both a curiosity and a project to him. Because as a personal trainer, someone like Dave needs testimonials from people like me. And yet, I lack the two essential ingredients every trainer needs from their clients: willpower and discipline. Money doesn't hurt either, but I lacked all three. And as a friend and trainer, I do believe he was actually concerned for me. He would often drop these hints like, oh, you should try this snack. It's got no sugar in it. You know, stuff like this. But on this day, it wasn't a hint. The news he had to share with me had the urgency of those guys on soapboxes at the street corner there. He was so keen to share it. He said, Brad, I've got something for you. This is the perfect thing for someone like you. Someone like me. It's never good to hear that phrase, someone like you. I wasn't quite sure what he meant, but I was like, well, what is it? He said, hot yoga. Now, at the time, I'd done yoga a handful of times. I didn't loathe it, I suppose. I didn't exactly love it either. It's kind of indifferent to the whole thing. So I said, what's hot yoga? He said, well, yoga, but hot, very hot. Again, I wasn't in love with the idea of yoga at the time, and I generally abhor feeling hot, so his pitch wasn't working well for me. It was kind of like, it felt to me like someone said, how do you feel about advertisements on television? And me being like, don't really care for them. And then someone being like, yeah, but what about watching them when it's really hot? Well, it's not sweetening the deal. But he was insistent. Come on, you've got it. I'll go with you. Just please. He's begging me. Give it a shot. So, fair enough. We signed up and we're going to class together. And the night before, I texted him, what does one wear to hot yoga? He said, well, just come in a bathing suit or short shorts. I balked, okay? I didn't love the idea of parading around my rather poorly sculpted body for others to see. Further, wearing short shorts, you know, the ones I'm talking about, the kind that just cover your most intimate parts, I mean, that was just too much for me. I happen to think I have decent calves, but, you know, everything else, I wasn't keen on really showcasing to others, but I hoped maybe hot yoga would be the fix for this very problem. And so I ignored his advice, and I decided I was going to show up in a tracksuit. Not a windbreaker tracksuit. Thick. Thick, 100% cotton, Walmart discount rack. Stretchy band, hoodie. That's what I was going to show up in. Because it seemed to me like it would give me the modesty I value, while giving me the flexibility for the eagle pose, you know, things like that. So I figured, you know, how hot could it be? It turns out very hot. Think of a scorched desert landscape like Death Valley, except it's that hot, but it's a humid heat, like sweat pouring out of every orifice of your body, constantly worrying about passing out. If you've never tried hot yoga, imagine going to hell and it's a yoga class. And I knew the moment I got in there, I had made a grave mistake. No sane person would try this in a tracksuit. In fact, people in bathing suits, I thought they were overdressed. But I had my pride. I was determined I was going to finish this in my tracksuit. 10 minutes passed, 15, 20. I'm just covered in sweat at this point, and I realized something's got to give. It's a 90-minute class. At 30 minutes, I could bear no more. I tore off my sweatshirt and my sweatpants, despite having extensively used boxer briefs on underneath. That's all I had, but I couldn't. I was going to pass out if I didn't. So now I'm in my boxer briefs, and everyone's doing the poses, and I'm pretending to meditate just so I can get by. And so the class goes. I'm just praying I won't pass out. And the class finally ends, and guru guy is like, okay, now to end the class, I want you to lay face up. I'm like, please just let me out of this hellhole. But he said, I want you to take the time to consider what's important to you. Take the time to breathe in gratitude. contemplate the gift of life. And every word he spoke, I'm like, I hate you. Just end this class. We're laying there, and finally, okay, class is done. I hear people move for the door, and I literally got up. I grabbed my sweaty, soaked tracksuit, my yoga mat, and I burst through the door into air-conditioned chilliness. And when the air-conditioned chilliness hit me, a wave of ecstasy fell upon me. Outside of sex, and at that, the best of sex, this might have been one of the greatest moments I've ever experienced in my life, coming into this like I was in a delighted frenzy. My body was drunk on the high of being released from this torture chamber. My skin was dancing in this frenzied delight. I felt like $1 million. And in that moment of ecstasy, Dave came through the door and he said, "Do you want to go to another class?" I said, "Of course I do. Of course I do." And so I bought a pass for 20 classes. That was 12 years ago. And there's 13 classes left on my pass. I only ended up going 7 times in the span of 12 years. What went wrong? Why didn't hot yoga stick for me? Well, I've been thinking about this. Upon reflection, a few things. The first is this. I had been brought to hot yoga out of fear. I don't have much willpower, discipline. But what Dave had done is he had convinced me that I was in danger. You don't take care of your health, you're going to die young, look awful, age with a slew of health issues, and 12 years later, he's not far from the money there, but I was scared. My fear of the future drove me to it. I would say this, fear is an excellent motivator in the short term, but rarely makes for a long-term impact. And unfortunately, Christianity is often sold under the same bill of goods. The reason you need this is because you should be scared about the future, your eternity. And it might make, if you're in a moment in a service, and there might be that moment where you're like, that makes sense to me, but fear is never a good long-term motivator. The second thing that happened to me in hot yoga was this. I had been convinced it might help me, but there was nothing about yoga or being hot while doing it that felt in any way compelling to me. Twisting and contorting my body as an exercise or way of life, it just never intrigued me. Why? I don't know. Perhaps that might change in the future, but at the time, I just didn't find it all that alluring. And so, reflecting on my yoga experience, I realized that my euphoric feelings had come from leaving hot yoga, not because of hot yoga. And what I loved about hot yoga was it being over and done with. And if you're still hanging with me through the story, this is precisely the point. I just don't find yoga that compelling. But I thought it was good and right for someone like me to do something like that. But something being right and good is rarely strong enough to keep us for the long haul. And last week, we started our series by talking about how we all need a path in life. That's good. That's true. It's right. We do. But if a path or lifestyle doesn't in some way captivate you, then being convinced it is right won't make much of a difference. We need a course to travel in life, but we also need one compelling enough to walk and travel. And you know, it's puzzling to me why certain things compel people but not others. And yet most of us can't deny we've got our things in life, right? There are certain activities or moments or peoples or ideas that are compelling. It like sweeps us up in a drama not of our own choosing. And we rarely control the things we're compelled by. It just happens. And that seemed to be what happened to some of Jesus' earliest followers. I hope last week I did enough to convince you that we all need a path to follow in life. But that's not enough. If you're going to travel the Jesus path, in some way, it's got to be compelling enough to make you start walking. So there's this cryptic story in the Gospels. Gospel of John has become very resonant to me. And according to John's artistic telling of Jesus' life and story, by the time we reach chapter 6 in the Gospel of John, Jesus is wildly popular, like Beatles-level popular. His closest followers at this point are basically just playing security detail. Try to maintain order in this chaos. But beginning in chapter 6, he's wildly famous and popular. By the end of the chapter, 70 verses later, all of it is gone. He'll lose almost all his fame and following within a single chapter. And the story of Jesus' dramatic loss of stardom, it's become important to me. And in the chapter, John tells us at the beginning, a great crowd of people followed Jesus. Whatever Jesus was saying and doing was connecting with the masses on an unprecedented scale. And just when Jesus' height is, just when his fame is at its height, Jesus launches into one of the most bizarre speech sequences in all of the Gospels. He refers to himself as the bread of life. And the way he unpacks that's puzzling, troubling. This is what Jesus says: I'm the bread of life. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. But here is the bread that comes down from heaven, which anyone may eat and not die. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world. Then the Jews began to argue sharply among themselves, how can this man give us his flesh to eat? I think it's important to note, but at this point, Jesus must have, you know, sort of got that, I think my brand messaging's off here. You know, I had all the hits, and now, I don't know if they're like this experimental phase. And an intelligent marketer at this point would have changed course, held a news conference. Hey, everyone, just chill out. I was speaking symbolically. Jesus could have corrected the cannibalistic nature of his language here, but he doesn't. In fact, what he does is he double downs on it. Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise them up at that last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me, and I in them." Whew, this is bizarre, uncomfortable language. I mean, Jesus talking about loving people with some signs and wonders, boom, he's got himself a traveling show, but my flesh is real food? My blood is real drink? It's getting a little creepy. And then this, on hearing it, many of his disciples said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it?" Then a short time later, from this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. You think? Following this Jesus guy is getting hard and peculiar. Many people are having second thoughts about being on the Jesus bandwagon, and who could blame them? Without question, without getting into what Jesus is talking about here, this is strange teaching. But it's what follows this mass exodus that captivates me most. It may single-handedly sum up my own fascination with Jesus. And he's watching as his followers walk away. He turns to his inner circle, his closest friends and followers, and ask them, "You do not want to leave too, do you?" There's a weight of vulnerability here with Jesus, maybe even a hint of doubt. It's as though he's going, shoot, maybe I pushed that a little far. But let me push the metaphor again here. It's as though people have been following Jesus on the Jesus path, and it's been like walking through a meadow, and it's like, oh, this is pretty good. But it seems like all of a sudden they've got to the steep ridge and there's drop-offs on either side, and some people are looking at the path going, when we're walking through the meadow, that's fine, but I'm not going there. And it's interesting to me because for some people in hiking, encountering rugged terrain on a path means giving up. Oh, that's too dangerous, don't want to go there. For others, the challenge of a strenuous trail is what actually makes a hike alluring. And Peter seems to capture there, Jesus is vulnerable, maybe even doubting himself. "You're not going to go too, are you?" And Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life." More literal translation from Peter here might be this: "You have the words of life in the age." the words of life. And for me, I would say that right there sums up probably the entirety of my relationship with Jesus and the path I believe he's asked me to follow. And what I love and so resonate with about Peter here is that Peter doesn't respond in some grandiose fashion, right? He doesn't try to elevate himself above these simpleton peasants. He's not like, hey, these simpletons can't get it, but I do. He's just as confused as everyone. He's nervous. He's scared. He doesn't get what Jesus is talking about any more than the people who are walking away. He realizes the path he's on is a tough and confusing one, but for Peter, that makes it even more alluring. And all Peter seems to be sure of is this, I don't know about this guy, but in him, I recognize life. He can't work out the details in his mind. In fact, it seems clear Peter's not sure what to think. But what he can't deny is that he remains compelled by this Jesus figure. And in this Jesus figure, he senses life. And that I get. That resonates with me in my experience. Like Peter in Jesus, I recognize life. I think I've mentioned this before, but it's worth saying again. Brian Zahn was once asked, how do you keep up your fervor for Jesus? And he said, I don't. This is how he responded. I'm passionate for Jesus Christ because, first of all, I'm passionate about life. My own existence is a staggering phenomenon. I exist. How amazing is that? I'm not obligated to be. The world would turn around without me. The sun would rise and set. The tides would ebb and flow. The seasons would continue their cycles without my appreciation of them. But I do exist. I am aware. And I'm aware that I'm aware. I belong to the only race of animate beings in the world who can look upon the mountains and know that they are beautiful. I'm aware of my own existence and the possibilities it affords. I am passionate about life. Let me simply say it. If you're passionate about life, then the Jesus path is for you because Jesus represents a sort of sourceness of life. And Peter, in this passage, he's like, you've got the life, and I want to find it. I want to follow it. And like Peter before me, I don't fully know or understand, but what I cannot deny is that for me, Jesus is just well compelling. There's life there. I can feel it. And part of that, I think, is this. You see, to travel the Jesus path is not to follow a trail that's absent of its creator. To walk the Jesus path is to follow a presence. His path is marked by signs that he's close to us always, even as we walk. I have encountered Jesus on the Jesus path, and I expect you to as well. And I'm going to end it here this morning, ask the band to come. We're going to pick up, how do we know when we've encountered Jesus on the path? That's what we'll talk about next week. And what does it mean to be compelled by something? But Jesus' path, it gives us a direction. It gives us a way of life. But more than that, the contours of Jesus' trail serve to remind us that Jesus walks the path with us. God's spirit and presence are found there, continually speaking life, love, and encouragement. You know, I took a mountain hike with the kids this summer. It was the biggest one, 14 kilometers. We were going up to the ink pots in Banff, and we knew this was going to be grueling for them. But one of the things I find interesting about hiking in the mountains is that so often you're hiking, you're surrounded by trees, and you can't really see the mountains around you. It almost feels like it could be any forest. But for me, I don't know, one of the things that I found in hiking in the mountains is this. Even when you can't see the mountains, you can almost smell them. You know they're there, even though you're surrounded by trees. It's like, oh, I'm not just in any forest. I'm in the mountains. And what I want to talk about next week is this idea that even though sometimes it seems God or Jesus is absent, the trail and path if we're tuned in right, there are times we can smell it, we can feel it. And traveling the Jesus path is like that. God's presence on the path, it often feels hidden. But what makes the path so alluring is that if we're paying attention, God's presence can be felt. And as Peter experienced it, what it felt like was life and vitality. How do we know when we've encountered Jesus on the path? Let's talk about that next week. But the truth is, walking the Jesus path can feel challenging, and the terrain can feel precarious. But for those who are passionate about life, the Jesus path comes to us as something so compelling that, like Peter, we simply can't walk away or turn around. Like Peter, we sense we must keep following, searching, and exploring. So one more week at the trailhead, then we'll hop on to the path itself. But I wanted to start with the question of evangelism, and next week we'll move into what does it mean to be compelled and follow something that often feels dangerous or hard to find.